thoughts are coming from Deuteronomy chapter 30 today. To get a little background, we'll check out chapter 29 a little bit. I think it can easily be applied to us. We see a lot of parallels. Well, kind of a synopsis of chapter 29 is God saying, look what I've done for you to the Israelites. I mean, they've been through a lot together. God's done a lot for them. And they've made it through together. God's taken them through it. He's allowed them to succeed despite their trials, despite Egypt, lack of clothes and food, despite additional enemies. He's saying to them, you have abundant proof of your reliance on me. Abundant proof of your reliance on me. Because obviously they didn't do it alone. And then what does he do after saying this to them? He makes a covenant with them. And my first reaction is that really necessary? I mean, here he just showed them all the proof of their reliance on him, of their need for that partnership. But he makes a covenant with them. As if everything he's done is so easily forgotten. In the face of his omnipotence, are those lifeless idols really very appealing? But what did we just get done doing? Having a reminder of our reliance on God. He predicts in verse 19 of chapter 29, he says, man will say, I shall have peace, even though I follow the dictates of my own heart. Ever been that way? Things are going good. You feel like you've been doing well with God, got a good relationship going, and pretty soon you forget about the most important part of the picture, and you start focusing on yourself more than on who self relies on to get you where you're at. And you start thinking, I'll have peace, even though I follow the dictates of my own heart. He warns us that that mistake is not without consequence. He says, well, I have blessed you, of course, but I'm going to curse you if necessary. If you forsake my blessing, there's going to be a consequence for that. Verses 24 through 28. All the nations would say, why has the Lord done so to this land? What does the heat of this great anger mean? Then people will say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. For they went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods that they did not know and that he had not given to them. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against this land to bring on it every curse that is written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from the land in anger and wrath and in great indignation and cast them into another land as it is this day. Giving your worship to something that does not deserve your worship. Giving worship to something other than whom it belongs to. God is the only one deserving of our worship. But I see here that our God is an amazing combination of compassion, mercy, and justice, all at the same time. Which leads us right into chapter 30. Read verses 1 through 5. Now shall it come to pass, when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God drives you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all your heart and with all your soul, that the Lord your God will bring you back from the captivity you, and have compassion on you, and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. If any of you are driven out to the farthest parts under heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you. Then the Lord your God will bring you to the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. He will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. What stands out to me first about this little passage is the phrase, call to mind. Here they are in the middle of their tribulation, and they call to mind. It kind of paints a little picture to me. It's like their life here, it's a chaotic mess. Here they had been blessed by God. They had life going great. Then they forgot about it, turned to other things. The consequences were great. They're driven to other lands. what am I going to do, I would think. I would be at a loss of what to do. It's like my life and my plan is crumbling around my feet, right? And it's like that little light bulb. And they call to mind the Lord and the things that He has done, the things that He has promised to do. This phrase, call to mind, means to turn back and withdraw your mind. It's like you're pulling your mind out of the cobwebs, the vines, the thorns, the sins that so easily entangle us. It's like you take a step back with it. Examine it. Examine the world. Examine the Lord. And you put it all back together again. It's like thinking outside the box. It's like the Lord's Supper. Taking a step back from a chaotic life. Seeing this world for what it really is. Seeing our lives for what it really is. And acting accordingly. It's calling it to mind. So what's the result of that action? That you will return and obey with all your heart and all your soul. Well, naturally we all screw up. So what are we going to do? Is our life like the edge of a knife? One false move and that's it? It's over? Well, Proverbs 24 verse 16 says, "The righteous man may fall 7 times and rise again, but the wicked will fall by calamity." Joel 2 verse 13 says, "Return to the Lord your God, for He is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness." The fact that brings relief to me and gratitude is that our God is compassionate and He's merciful. The fact that we can return is what really stands out to me. Are you grateful for that? Do you take it for granted? Do you realize what your life could be like? You know, 8 times in this chapter alone, God says to return and obey with all your heart and with all your soul. 8 times. And what I see here is the word all. It especially stands out to me. In the songs of faith and praise, there's the song, "All in All." "You are my strength when I am weak. You are the treasure that I seek. You are my all in all." Think about all that God is to you. If you can. I can. What does He mean to your life? What would your life be like without Him? Other than non-existent. You know, there is joy in this life. A fruit of the Spirit. Because of God's all-consuming presence. That is the source of your joy. That is the source of anything good. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. How about verses 3 and 4? "The Lord your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. If any of you are driven out to the farthest parts under heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you and there He will bring you back." This reminds me of sheep. We had a lot of sheep back in Missouri. Not a lot, but enough. And I remember one particular time, I was probably 12 or 13. And they got out early in the morning. And I had to bring them back. And I had to run several miles, I'm sure, and over many hills. God bless Missouri. Yeah, and sheep. And I was ready for breakfast whenever I was done, but I finally got them back. I had to go to great lengths to get those stinking sheep back, just so they could get out again tomorrow. But it pales in comparison to what He did to bring us back. What did He say? "If any of you are driven to the farthest parts of under heaven, there He will get you, gather you, bring you back." How far did He go to bring you back? Remember the Lord's Supper? Calling to mind? Are you grateful for that? How about the end of verse 5? "He will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers." He's, despite the curse that you brought upon yourself, He's willing to bless you more and more each and every day. Verse 6, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live. You know, this is the verse that initially caught my eye about this chapter. So what an interesting phrase. I don't think I've ever seen that before. He will circumcise your heart. What exactly does this mean? Well, in this case, the heart is everything that makes up your being. Well, it's not physical or tangible. It's you, yourself, your character, your insides. Well, what's circumcision? It's cutting away that which is unneeded, potentially harmful. Part of the definition of the Hebrew word for circumcision is destroy. You know, sometimes there's things in our life, in our heart, that need destroyed, that are unneeded, potentially harmful, that God needs to cut away. Circumcision is also a sign of a covenant. Remember Abraham? It's like God is staking his claim on your heart. This is mine, he says. Ezekiel 36, 26 and 27. I will give you a new heart, put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. You will keep my judgments and do them. Where does your heart belong? Who has claimed your heart and its contents? Have you claimed your heart? Is it yours? Want to keep for yourself, do with it what you want? How about the flesh and its pleasures? Anything that happens to catch your fancy? Has that claimed your heart? You, your character, your inside? Or have you turned it over to God for the cleansing, the removal of anything potentially harmful or unneeded? Anything excess that just gets in the way? Only He can do it. Remember the lengths that he went to circumcise your heart. Remember who bought it and at what price. And think about what he can do with you when he gives you that new heart, takes away the one of stone, when he puts his spirit inside you. Are you grateful for that? Then we're told what to fill our heart with, this new heart that we're given, this circumcised heart. It says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live. This is the source of life. And without it, it's nothing but death, naturally. This is that phrase stated 8 times in this chapter. All your heart, all your soul. It's the answer to the meaning of life. Everybody wants to know. Everybody is hardwired to want to know what is the meaning of this thing called life. You know the song, I Surrender All? Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis mentions our tendency to give God bits and pieces of our life. Makes the analogy of a tree, giving him a branch here, twig there, part of the tree there. It's still my tree. I'm still this tree. I'm just going to give you this. I'm going to give you my Sunday mornings. I'm going to give you that bad habit. I'm going to give you this and that. But he says God doesn't want a limb here and a limb there. He wants the whole tree down. He wants something new. Colossians talks a lot about the old man and the new man. Put away the old man. Take on the new. Our baptism, what is it a symbol of? It's a burial of the old man so that we can rise up completely new, nothing old. How much of the old man do we keep around? How does that work? Have you given all? Giving part of your life doesn't do any good. Because then it's still part of your life. Jeremiah 29 verse 13 says, that you may seek me and find me and search for me with all your heart. You know, you never really accomplish much if you don't do it wholeheartedly. And that's most true concerning our relationship with the giver of life and the sustainer of life. We give him all because we acknowledge him as our source of all. There's that song again. You are my strength when I am weak. You are the treasure that I seek. You are my all in all. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9. Oh, that sound familiar? Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. This is encompassing every, all part of their lives, right? So that they can be reminded of it at all times. Anything they look at. Walk out the door, oh, there's the scripture. There's a reminder of my covenant with my God, that he owns me, that he deserves my all in all. What a joy to hand over your life and every detail to the source of love, compassion, mercy, the one who created us. Seems awfully simple. Proverbs 3, verse 6 says, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. And what I find so amazing about this is that God wants to be involved in all our ways. He's asking that we involve him in all our ways so that he can make our paths straight. He wants to guide us. Are you grateful for that? Do you know how much that's worth? Verses 11 through 14. This commandment which I command you today is not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear and do it? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. I'm grateful for the fact that God and his commands, his word, is so accessible to us. It's not in heaven that somebody has to go get it. It's not across the sea that somebody has to somehow travel across it to go get it. It's right here. Understandable. Not super complex. His command is right here. It's imminent. And sometimes I feel like my life resembles a paddle ball. Like the paddle is God and I'm the ball. I come close and, oh, it's so great. But then stretches out again, get far away. And then it comes back in. It's just over and over. Just this continual undulation. And I doubt that it'll ever really change. But there are infallible promises that we can partake of only when we draw near to God. James 4:8 says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Is it really possible to be clean and pure when you're not near God? Is it possible to be warm when you're 50 feet away from a fire? Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. And I think you'll find that the defilements of this world just can't hold on to you in the face of the source of all things pure. Think about that. Do you think if you're holding an ice cube in your hand and you stand 6 inches from a fire, that ice cube is going to be able to stay ice? Probably not. You suppose God works the same way? If you've got something clinging to you and you draw near to the source of all things pure, you think it's going to be able to hold on? I kind of doubt it. And speaking of holding fast, Deuteronomy 11 verse 22 says, love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to hold fast to him. I love that phrase because it paints this picture of necessity, of your only hope. It's like the safety raft to the person drowning. It's like the rope to the mountain climber. What do those two things mean to those two different situations? It means you better hold on to it or you're going to die. And it means that if you do hold on to it, you're probably going to be okay. Holding fast to God is an act of submission and surrender. It's acknowledging God as your only hope for survival, only hope for success, only hope for joy, happiness, prosperity, salvation, future. I could go on. Jeremiah 13:11 says, "As the sash clings to the waist, cling to me, that you may become my people for renown, for praise, and for glory." But they would not hear. That doesn't really make any sense. Imagine somebody knocking on your door. "Would you like some renown, praise, and glory?" "No thanks. All you have to do is hold on to this." "No thanks." "What?" Who would really do that? But that's what they did, and that's what I do. And that's why we have our covenant, our memorial, every first day of the week. Remember what you're holding on to? Remember the renown, praise, and glory that you're promised? Don't forget why you're holding on to it, and don't let go. Verses 15 through 18, back in Deuteronomy 30. "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. And that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, that you may live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. But if your heart turns away, so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish." You know, every day we are faced with this decision. Every moment. Because Satan is just as real as God. And there's just as much of a battle going on. Just like Joshua, chapter 24, verse 15, "Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." And then he announces, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Maybe I should do that every morning. Maybe I should wake up and tell myself, "Choose for yourself this day." Because sometimes you just got to take it a day at a time. Forever is a long time. Choose for yourself this day, who are you going to serve? "I will serve the Lord." And then do it. Probably be a pretty good day. But it takes resolve to continually say, "I will serve the Lord." Because there's a lot of other things sending pitches to you. "How about this? Serve this." But our way is plainly marked. He says here, "I have set before you today life and good, death and evil." Here it is. Life and good, death and evil. Choose for yourself. How are you going to act? And which one is it going to reflect? Matthew 7:13-14. "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it." It's popular. "Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." Which path are you going to take? It didn't promise it would be easy. In fact, it promises it's going to be difficult. But the hardest things in this life tend to have the greatest rewards. We're commanded in verse 16 to love the Lord your God, walk in his ways, and keep his commandments. He has shown us the way. Walk in his ways that he has already done, that he has set before us, that he has not only described, but exemplified. He has performed the commandments we are to keep. He's not just told us, he's shown us. And I find that encouraging, because it means it's not impossible. John 13:15, Jesus says to his disciples, and by the way, this is right after washing their feet, which is interesting to note, "I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Mark 8:34, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. He is our infallible guide to follow. How can we perform the commandment? Well, he did, so do what he did. Psalm 23:4 says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and staff comforts me. Just like he promised in Matthew 7, saying that the way is narrow and difficult, and there are few who are going to be with you on this way. It's not going to be popular, and it's not going to be a party. But they are his ways. Which means that there is something good at the end. They are where he is, ready to guide, help, and comfort us. Righteous man may fall 7 times and rise again. Because he's on his ways. He's walking the path of Christ. Walk in his ways. Appreciate the provisions he's made for you. Be thankful for that. But of course, there's always that threat of deceitfulness in the heart. After all, it needed circumcised. And this is in verse 17. But if your heart turns away, so that you do not hear, and are drawn away, and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you that you'll surely perish. This is where it's especially important to cling to him. To make sure that heart is continually circumcised by the Lord, claimed by him, cleansed by him, be full to the brim of God's love. Otherwise, it will turn away. That's really the only answer to keeping from turning away. I like the analogy of the cup, that you've got a cup and then you've got God's love. And he pours it into the cup until it's full, but he doesn't stop. He keeps going until it flows over. And that's where our love for others comes in. It's vital for that cup to be full so it can flow over. Otherwise, there's plenty of other things that are more than ready to fill the void, right? Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. When he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him 7 other spirits, more wicked than himself. They enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. So what was the issue here? The issue wasn't that it was swept nice and clean and put in order. It was that there was nothing filling the void. The last state was worse than the first. We are told to put off that old man, but it does no good if you don't put on the new. Ephesians 4:22-24. That you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you may put on the new man which was created according to God in the righteousness and holiness. Chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. That Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you being rooted and grounded in love may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and height, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, what an oxymoron, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. We have to fill our hearts with his love. Otherwise, there's plenty of other things that are more than ready to fill that void. Like in 1 Kings, whenever Solomon finally finished the temple, and they began offering sacrifices, and God filled the temple so that even the priests couldn't operate in there anymore. They had to quit giving sacrifices because God's presence was in there and nothing else could be in there. I find that really neat. A good analogy for us. Make it to where the only operable thing inside your heart is God's love and His glory. Verses 19 and 20. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey His voice, and that you may cling to Him, for He is your life. I already talked about the importance of love and obedience to God, of drawing near and clinging to Him, but what stands out to me here is the reason for all these actions. It's manifested in verse 20. Why should we love Him, obey Him, cling to Him? Because He is life. Ever thought about what you would be without Him? It's not very fun. Psalm 119, 92, and 93. Unless your law had been my delight, I would then have perished in my affliction. I will never forget your precepts, for by them you have given me life. Galatians 2:20. I am crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. The life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave Himself for me. Colossians 3, verse 4. When Christ, who is our life, appears, you also will appear with Him in glory. He has proven Himself above and beyond worthy of our worship, of our dedication, of our all. When I recall this chapter, there's a lot of different things that bring comfort to me. I'm reminded of how God spared no expense to bring us back. He staked His claim on our hearts and cleansed it from anything excess, unnecessary, potentially harmful. I think about how He is always near us when we walk on His paths, because they're His paths. I think about how He has laid the way before us, not just given us a map and a compass, but walked it already. How He makes our paths clear and straight. I'm reminded of Ephesians 2, verse 1. You He made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins. Are you grateful that He took the death that you deserve to give you life and to be your life? I am. If you've not taken advantage of that opportunity, we encourage you to as we stand and sing.